93 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. suspends his independent presidential bid and endorses Republican candidate Donald Trump before appearing with him at his Glendale, Arizona rally.
And don't you want a president who's going to get us out of the wars and who's going to rebuild the middle class in this country?
RFK Jr. says his decision to endorse Trump has caused tension with his family. Several Secret Service agents have been put on leave. It's in response to the agency's investigation into the assassination attempt on former President Trump. CBS's Nicole Skanga reports.
Secret Service officials put on administrative leave, hold on to their badges, their paychecks, and importantly, their security clearances. But their day-to-day protective assignments are typically exchanged for desk jobs.
Mass stabbing at a music festival in the German town of Solingen. The BBC's Stuart McIntosh.
Police said three people were killed and several others injured. The attacker is still at large.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The four hotel workers arrested in the death of Devante Mitchell have pleaded not guilty. Prosecutors allege they pinned Mitchell to the ground in June. He later died. The defendants include two security workers, a front desk employee, and a bellhop. They're charged with felony murder. They each face up to almost 16 years in prison if convicted. All four defendants are expected back in court October 15th. And a Wisconsin company scored a huge new military contract. Here's Lisa Hale.
Oshkosh Defense is awarded a $1.54 billion five-year contract to build new and refurbished heavy tactical vehicles and trailers for the U.S. Army. Oshkosh Defense has produced over 71,000 heavy tactical vehicles for the United States and other nations. The Army can start buying vehicles from Oshkosh Defense on the contract this month.
And that's what you need to know. I'm Savannah Tome Olson, and this is Civic Media News.
CapTime's Idea Fest is back for a week of powerhouse speakers and sessions exploring important local and national topics. September 15th through the 21st in Madison. This year's guest speakers include Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, former member of Congress Liz Cheney, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, and historian Heather Cox Richardson, along with many others. Idea Fest brings together changemakers to discuss Wisconsin's triumphs and failures to help reach a better state. Purchase your tickets today at CapTimesIdeaFest.com to join this premier thought festival.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk to you about as we come to you from Chicago, the UC, the United Center of the Democratic National Convention. Been following this all week. We've been grabbing people here in the hall, and I want to start right off with one of my favorite people, Ben Jealous. He's the chief cook and bottle washer over there at the Sierra Club now. You may remember he was the guy from the People for the American Way. What a resume. Don't have time for it. But Ben Jealous, how are you, buddy?
Good to see you, sir. Good to see you. You know, I am so excited about the change we've seen in our prospects since Kamala Harris has been the head of the ticket. We got a real shot here. You know, like you, man, I'm excited that we're opening factories again in America. All right? This world economy is going in one direction. China knows it. It's going towards batteries. It's going towards EVs. It's going towards changing the way the entire planet is powered to sun and to wind. The only question is, are we going to lead the world economy or China? And every time you hear Donald Trump, you know, bashing EVs or whatever, he really disrespects the people of Detroit. Yeah, there's debate. Do I want an EV in my driveway or not? You know, there's no debate over, do we want Detroit to build them or do we want China to build them? I think we're pretty much all in agreement on that. But when he poo-poos it, man, it hurts the future of Detroit. And that's fundamentally what we all need to be focused on, is making sure we rebuild the American manufacturing sector to seize the moment in the world and make sure we lead the world economy, not China.
So I now got to stop because you're the environmental guy. Mm. You're the Sierra Club.
Yeah.
What are you talking about manufacturing for? You're supposed to be talking about trees and water and that stuff.
So we got two big foci at Sierra Club, okay? We have our traditional work. We're the people who brought you the national park system. We would love to see it doubled because, you know, working people, we love our parks. And, man, you go there on a holiday weekend, there's a lot of traffic getting in. We also are the folks who are like the Jane the Baptist and the John the Baptist for decades saying, you know, there's a new economy coming. Well, now it's here. And now that it's here, we got to build it and we got to make sure it takes root and it flourishes. And, you know, there's a lot of hope in it. I mean, think about it. You know, last time I was crisscrossing the country for a green group, it was 30 years ago. We were fighting NAFTA. It was me and the head of the IBEW crisscrossing the country. I was organizing students. He was organizing workers. And we would speak together. And we said, and we were called like the Chicken Little tag team by some right-wing folks, because we were saying, look, you pass NAFTA, you will gut American manufacturing, you'll gut American manufacturing, and you will send these factories overseas to places that will not enforce environmental regulations. You'll accelerate the poisoning of the planet. And then I watched my entire adult life, because I was 20 then, us get proven right. We shut down 65,000 American factories.
And millions of jobs.
Millions of jobs.
Millions of shattered lives, broken communities. Suicide. All the things that we now look back on and go, horrible mistake, should have listened to, well, me and you and all the other people who were against NAFTA.
Yeah, well, you know, and people say, you know, like, Ben, like, where does this energy, and I'll tell you where the energy comes from. Yeah, you know, like, the white side of my family's from Maine, the textile industry imploded, black side of my family's from Baltimore, the steel industry, the glass industry, all that imploded. But when I was 10, my good buddy across the street, we played together every day. Their dad worked at the tire factory. The tire factory shut down. He went down the basement and blew his brains out. And that's really like where like my vendetta against this comes from. I remember what it did to my friends, and one of them died because he lost his mind after his dad died. And then you replicate that across 65,000 factories. That's what's happened. Now, most Americans, man, we have the same address. It is, I live where there used to be a factory, and when that shut down, what shot up? Despair, suicide, poverty, opiates, meth.
Yeah, no, we saw it in 2022 when we did our Working Class Heroes tour. We went to those places that used to be where the factory was the heart of that community, was the lifeblood of that economy. And when it left, exactly as you said, it was the drugs, it was the alcohol, it was the domestic violence, it was all the negatives skyrocketed. And all of the positives that those good union jobs created were all gone.
No, that's exactly right. And what created those jobs really was America saying, you know what, where is the science taking industry? Okay, we're going to get ahead of that curve and we're going to seize that moment. Well, right now, if you ask that question, where is science taking industry? It is towards renewable energy. It is towards batteries and EVs. The Chinese have figured this out. They are massively subsidizing all those things over there, trying to undercut every other nation on planet Earth so that our factories fail. In the last year, we've seen the cost of Chinese-created solar panels cut 50%. Then they introduce an EV that's $14,000. And all of that is the result, not that like they've got like folks creating cars and that they can actually get a profit on for $14,000. No. Their government massively subsidized all of this, and it's a long game. They say, look, we did this with Solyndra. We did this in America 12 years ago. They started to build up manufacturing capacity. We undercut them, drove them out of business. We're going to do that again.
It's not just Solyndra. It's not that. It's with bicycles. It's with toys. It's with everything that we've seen. Because ultimately, when we gave permanent normal trade relations to them, we were told, oh, no, no, they're going to bring in products. We're going to compete. You're going to be able to go to the store, buy an American-made product or a Chinese-made product. Well, that American-made product is gone.
No, and here's the thing, and that could be like your flat-screen television, and all of our weapon systems run off of flat screens. We don't make them. But, you know, what happened? COVID. Suddenly, America didn't have enough toilet paper. America didn't have enough, couldn't even produce enough ventilators or masks. And the damage that we saw as guys from working-class families happened to our neighborhoods where our parents grew up or we grew up, suddenly everybody in the country and the leadership class had to recognize, oh, my gosh, we don't make anything anymore. And so you see Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, the deciding vote, passing Inflation Reduction Act, massive investment in fighting climate change, massive investment in rebuilding American manufacturing to seize this moment. And, man, if we get eight more years What does that mean? That means that those industries flourish. That means that, honestly, politics get less toxic. I mean, Rick, just take a trip with me a second to Dalton, Georgia. Dalton, Georgia is the, I would say, the heart of darkness in American politics, at least so far as their congresswoman goes, because it's Marjorie Taylor Greene's district, right? And I, you know, dad is from Maine. Mom is from Baltimore. Dad's family, you know, my favorite uncle works in a lumberyard. Mom's family, folks work at the airport. And all of them hurting from the deindustrialization. And so I go down to Dalton, Georgia, and I see the rainbow that is my family on that factory floor. You know, I see a guy with a red face and a beard down to his belly, right next to a guy with, you know, a brown brother with a tight fade, next to a woman who did not grow up speaking English. They're all laughing. They're all working together. They're all making stuff with their hands. They're feeling the pride. They're feeding the families. And it's a lot better job than the rug factory next door where they had to wear diapers from all the humidity. And just to get to absorb that humidity and not be in pain. And they are happy. And then you are walking out of the factory, and there's all these watercolors and Crayola drawings on the wall, and it's from last year's Earth Day competition where the factory workers' children were asked to depict how they see their parents working at the solar panel factory. And 2 of 1, you know, those children of rednecks, right? Those children of descendants of slaves, those children of immigrants depicted their parents as heroes saving the planet. And you're like, wow, if this is the future of Dalton, Georgia, if we replicate this times 1,000 or 65,000, what happens to America? Yeah. We come back together.
We make those places that used to be the places that are going to be.
Yes.
And that's what sound policy, smart investment really is all about.
Yep.
And that's what I hope comes out of this, because sadly what Trump and his plan tried to sell is that we're going to recreate the 1950s. Those jobs are never coming back. We're not getting those 65,000.
And neither is segregation, which is literally part of their fantasy.
Sure. And none of that stuff is all coming back. Yeah. It's going forward. And it's holding on to these new industries. It's encouraging the incubation of these new industries and also holding on to them.
Yes.
Sadly, all of the innovation we've done over the last 30 years has been exported.
Yeah, well, and the other thing, honestly, right? I mean, again, you kind of see with, like, the rug factory, right? Like, you say to somebody, like, how do you like working the solar? You know, like, well, you know, it's temperature controlled in here. I'm not working in an environment between, like, an oven, you know what I'm saying, and, like, glue, inhaling, you know, what? And every day, even in the winter, I'm dripping in sweat, and so that's why they wear the diapers. They don't get, because they're literally, it's very uncomfortable. And then so, like, that's great. And you're like, wow, this is a much more dignified job.
No,
right?
but this is the thing.
But then here's the other thing, right? That coal-fired power plant that these solar panels, like, will make not necessary, that's the reason, in many cases, grandma died of a heart attack and the kids have asthma. Sierra Club shut down 385 coal-fired power plants. Next year, we will celebrate 100,000 heart attacks prevented and 1 million asthma attacks prevented. And let's make it plain. Those are, where do they put those factories? Next to poor white folks and working class people of color, right? Poor black folks, poor Latinos. They are happy to kill us. They don't want those, like, by the suburbs. They don't want this by the rich folks. So those are our heart attacks. Those are our asthma attacks that get prevented. This is a healthier way
That was my childhood. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, right next to Hopkins International Airport.
Yes.
I suffered from asthma all the way up until I was about 15 when I moved into a much better neighborhood with my grandparents. And I don't have asthma today, fortunately. Because it was the environment. It wasn't.
But think of all the childhood experiences you missed.
Oh, yeah.
Because they decided it was okay to poison your community.
No, and look, I remember watching the news at night, making sure that the air pollution was okay for me to go outside.
Yeah.
Those are the days that we came from.
Yeah.
So when we talk about recreating manufacturing, kind of want to do that in a better way.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So last line of questioning I want to get to you, because, you know, there's this idea that we can't do this stuff. I have my Sierra Club friends who are like, no, we should bring all those EVs in from China because we need to get to this zero as soon as possible. Don't care about the jobs, care about the environment. Is it possible to have the manufacturing and get to where we need to go without surrendering our economy or
100%.
Or all of us just standing around looking at each other?
Well, I mean, 100%. I mean, this is the fundamental different thing about being an environmentalist now than it was, say, when I was a kid, which is like, American manufacturing was destroyed by NAFTA. It was destroyed by corporate greed. So now we get to build new factories. They are cleaner factories, they are smarter factories, and they are building the technologies that clean our air, right? The technologies that will make it possible to restabilize our climate and get out of this season of superstorms. And so, yeah, and, you know, we get to like reap a lot of the good and avoid a lot of the poison.
Is it possible to undo the damage we've already done? Can the planet heal itself?
The planet
from the
can
damage
heal itself. I mean, we saw that with NAFTA.
I mean, because the planet will be fine.
Yeah,
that's us or a screw.
Yes, no. I mean, look, we saw it with NAFTA. People were driving less, and literally, you saw like forests start to like kind of green because they didn't have dust all over the leaves. You saw water get clearer because the pollutants from the tailpipes weren't going into the water. You saw nature heals itself. We as humans destroy it. And, you know, as a person of faith, as a Christian growing up, the first commandment I learned was protect the garden. It was Genesis. You know what I'm saying? It was on the road towards Jesus. Like, yes, the world will heal itself if we stop polluting it and destroying it at the massive rate that we are right now.
So the difference between the Harris Walls ticket and the Trump
ticket is that the Harris Walls ticket, this is fundamental American capitalism. This is fundamental American leadership. This is saying the science is heading this direction. Like Wayne Gretzky, let's get to where the puck is going and let's lead. And Trump is literally in the rearview mirror about to drive us off a cliff. You know, he's not looking through the windshield. He's not paying attention to where the world economy is going. He's living in this nostalgia act. And the reality is, every day that we delay really owning the future of the green economy is a day that privileges China to take the lead, and that's nothing that we can afford.
So, last real quick question: thoughts of this the shindig here? What's your vibe?
Oh man, my vibe is so good, bro. It literally, you know, I've been active in presidential politics since I was a 14-year-old organizer for Jesse Jackson. And you often show up. I remember the switch from like the Jackson energy to Dukakis, right? And it was just like, you know, it went from like transformation to like, we're going to try not to lose, you know? And this year it feels like we're playing to win. And I love playing to win.
No, but by all means, I the energy in this room, just amazing. But Ben Jealous, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Appreciate you, Rick.
Good stuff. Want to hear your thoughts. Can we do all those wonderful things? I want to hear your thoughts right back after this. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Democratic National Convention here in Chicago, and I have run into a good friend, former Alabama Senator Doug Jones is here to share some thoughts on the convention and Tim Walz's speech. Doug, great seeing you, buddy.
It's great to see you, Rick. It's always good to be in person rather than across a computer screen.
Absolutely. So let's get right to this. You've done this a lot. You've been to these before. Thoughts?
Unbelievable. I mean, I'm telling you, Rick, this convention is one for the ages. It is exciting. There is more energy. There has been laughter. There's been cheers. There's been tears. There's been everything. But what it has done, frankly, is reflect America. It reflects the best of America. It reflects what we need to be, the unity, the spirit. Everything about this has just been extraordinary.
No, I watched Tim Walz's speech, And you know, look, it reminded me of my high school years.
Absolutely.
My high school football coach. And I threw it out on Twitter and said, hey, share some of those thoughts of that coach that inspired your life or pushed you to be better. And the response was incredible.
Well, you know, what I've told some folks this morning, I did a couple of speeches, and I said, I'm so glad right now, coming from Alabama, okay?
Don't go to the football thing
no,
with this.
No, I'm going, man. I'm going there because I am so glad that the Democrats are giving football coaches that can go into the politics a good name again, okay?
I'm going there with you because we've got the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate right now from your state, sadly. But, no, look, he gave that speech last night, and it took me back to my old high school football days because that's the speech that guy's given 1,000 times.
Well, and I got to tell you, Rick, I've been to a lot of these conventions, and the speech was great, the going back to the football team. But when that team, his former players, walked out on that stage with their jerseys on, their old – I mean, that was one of the most special moments I have seen at a convention. And it sends such an incredible message, I think, to America, that these are guys that you can trust. These are guys that you would talk to in a locker room over a beer. Somebody, it was just a remark. You could feel it in the audience. It was amazing.
And you could feel the bond that they had with
Absolutely.
This guy. And then the story that they told, and this is, you know, as I'm watching some of the right-wing attacks on Tim Walz, and they're going to come.
Sure.
They're petty. They're pathetic. But, you know, they're attacking someone who is radically normal.
With popular policies and, you know, incredibly successful with everything that he has done. And his policies, the things he's gotten done in Minnesota, people say, well, they're too progressive, they're too liberal, they're too this, they're too that. And I just say, no, let's just put one label on them, popular. They're because they are what Minnesota wanted. They're the same kind of things that America wants. It's the same kind of things of, you know, giving kids lunches, making sure that, you know, they have good nutrition, making sure there's health care decisions, making sure women have the right that they deserve to control their own bodies. You name it, you can go down the line. And that's what he's done there. And that's what he can take, I think, to Minnesota. And those policies, Rick, I think are popular in areas that you and I go to a lot, but they don't always listen because Democrats have been kind of demonized, and so they immediately turn you off.
Right.
Not anymore. Not with Tim at the second spot on this ticket. I think people are going to pay attention and listen.
No, look, I people ask me how I've come to my political positions, and I said it's life. You know, I've had all of these things happen to me. I've had this helping hand. My mother passed when I was 13. We got Social Security survivor benefits, right, much like Tim Walz. You know, I went to school. I lived in a high poverty area. I had to get free school lunches, had to go to a separate line. So to me, that's a sore spot, something policy-wise I would want to change. And I listened to Tim Walz speak. We follow the same path. The things that we've experienced that we want to change, he's done.
And your experience is so much like so many people in America, and so many that are trying to make up their minds about which way they're going to vote right now. Or either they think they've made up their mind, but they're not quite sure because they look on the other side of the aisle and they see nothing but chaos and division and darkness, you know, and retribution. That's not what people in America, that's not the goodness of America that I think Tim Walz and Kamala does the same thing. Her spirit of helping others that she's always done.
No, these are normal people.
Right.
These are people who've lived in who've walked the same streets that we have.
Exactly.
These are people who have suffered the same kind of struggles that we have come from the working class of this country, which is something I think we've talked about, and I know I've talked about extensively, that I want people like me in those seats to make decisions to help people like me.
Absolutely. They have come up through the ranks. They have experienced the highs, the lows. They are still working for people, and yet they will take the time to put themselves out there, to go through what these guys are going through with all the – I mean, this is not an easy process to run for president and vice president.
No, but, and look, I look at his family, and his family is just amazing and beautiful, and all the things you want to throw on there. I mean, the reaction from his son last night was just, how could you not be almost drawn to tears
Now, let me tell you, my wife had to come apart when she looked up at that big monitor and saw that. We were sitting in the Alabama delegation. She saw that and saw both of those kids, and she just went to pieces because she could relate to that. She can relate to that happiness and joy and just exuberance, and it was all over the place.
Yeah. You can't script that.
No, not a bit.
And that's the thing about this. It's been organic. It's been real. These are real people telling real stories, and for me, that's been outside of the labor message everywhere.
Right.
That's been one of the things that I'm going to walk away from it this way.
There's no question. Like I said a minute ago, they are reflecting America. Okay, they come from different backgrounds, from California to Nebraska all the way to Minnesota. They come from different backgrounds in different places, but they have come together for a common purpose, and that common purpose is us. And this election, Rick, is not just about them, and that's what I'm taking away from this, that they are truly showing to the world. It's not about Kamala Harris. It's not about Tim Walz. It's about you. It's about the people out there. It is about America, and it's going to be that legacy. And the question that I think people really have to ask themselves when they see the contrast between Harris and Walz versus Trump and Vance is, what kind of America do you want? Who are you wanting to lead this America? Because at the end of the day, Rick, and I think I may have said this to you before, at the end of the day, if you vote for a Donald Trump, it's not going to say anything about him. But it's going to say a lot about you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, you know, I've been following this. I've been following politics as you have been for decades. Never in my lifetime have the comparisons been so opposite.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. I mean, there's no, you know, the frame a while ago was, well, they're all alike. They're both parties are the same. No, not even close.
No. That, you know,
dog don't hunt.
No, that's exactly right. That dog don't hunt. And we can talk about that. And, you know, I told some folks, I spoke to several delegations this morning, that I think one of the things I'm proudest of with Democrats, and you know, I have been saying things for years. Democrats throughout the South have been saying this for years. And now we have finally done it. We have finally started taking back the flag. We have started taking back patriotism. We have taken back freedom, real freedom, as was said last night. And that's really important for, I think, the people of America to see that we mean this. We are sincere about our love for this country, as opposed to someone who says we're a bunch of losers.
Yeah, no, I look at Tim Walz, and that's all authentic, all real. I've got that neighbor.
Absolutely.
And the thing is that this ticket, I think the majority of the country can find something in either side or in the whole thing that they identify with. And Tim Walz, clearly someone that I identify with. But I talked with an African-American woman the other night, and she said, you know, I identify with Kamala Harris. We led the same lifestyle.
Yes. Look, what I've talked to a number of people about is this, that you see all these polls out there. Okay, what's the most important issue? The economy. Abortion, you know, jobs, the border, those kind of things. I don't think that there's that many people. I think the abortion issue is going to drive more votes than anything else, especially with women.
Sure.
But people are going to look at the whole package. And you're going to see in this ticket a lot of things you like, some that you don't necessarily like or disagree with. But that's not always the point. You can always find common ground. And that's what they're going to be doing. They're going to find that common ground. They're not going to be dividing people like the other side.
No, and the difference is I do believe that they will listen.
Absolutely.
You know, even if we're not on the same side, they're going to listen, and there's an opportunity to move them. The old FDR thing, you want me to do something? Get out there in the streets and make me do it.
Yeah, you know, look, I don't know Tim Walz. I've not met. I can't wait to get a chance to talk to him because we talk alike. In a lot of different ways. But I know Kamala Harris, and I know how she listens, and she responds. But she listens. She goes where people are. And that's what this whole convention has been about,
right?
Going where people are, going where America is.
Let's change streams a second, because on Monday night, President Biden came out and just killed it with an amazing speech and, you know, laid out what I think is his legacy. And the fact this is his legacy.
Right.
Any thoughts when you watch that speech?
Yeah,
because you're friends.
Oh, now I've been a part of Team Joe for 46 years now, and I got a chance to visit with him in the White House a couple of weeks ago. It was the same day that the prisoners were exchanged and they were coming home. We broke up our meeting so that he could go to Dover to meet those guys, and he was in a good mood. Look, Joe has had 50 plus years of incredible public service. I don't care what anybody says. He has been so demonized. He is a national treasure. The things that he has done, the way he has brought this economy back, the way he saved lives with health care, the way that he has brought our allies together and fortified our standing in the world. That's a really, you know, that for years, Rick, I think we took that for granted.
Yeah.
That we were the big, you know, we were the glue holding democracies around the world together, and it was coming apart. under Donald Trump, and it will come apart again. And he fortified NATO. He brought these countries together. We are now back to the moral leader of the world. And his legacy is going to be amazing. I've just been so proud of him, so proud of Jill and the entire family, and this administration to have been a part of it for at least a couple of months during Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation just means more to me than I can describe.
And in 200 years, we're going to learn about my great-great-great-great-grandchildren are going to learn about that selfless,
absolutely,
historic act of stepping aside and doing transformational administration, but passing the torch to a generation that I hope is going to carry this on well into the future.
Absolutely. Another George Washington moment. We haven't had one for 200-something years.
To me, the most important part is restoring the calm.
Yes.
It just, oh, yeah. That's it for me. But Doug, I know you got a lot of work to do, a lot of getting out there, spreading the message. Always great seeing you, my friend.
You too, buddy.
I look forward to talking to you again.
Come
real
back
soon
to Birmingham and let's get some more barbecue.
We're going to Saws, though.
Okay, we'll go
no
to
no question. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. The Shaw, WAUK. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Tonight, mostly clear, a low in the upper 50s. Mostly sunny, warmer, and more humid tomorrow, high in the low 80s. Some storms possible late Saturday night into Sunday, partly sunny and a high in the low 80s. On Monday, sunny, warmer, mid-80s and muggy. It's 67 right now.
Earl Ingram.
Mayor Brian Kennedy of Glendale.
I've heard Republicans say this is a coup. Nobody voted for Kamala Harris. Yeah, when I voted for Joe Biden in the primaries, I was voting for Kamala Harris to be his vice presidential running mate. In this case, Joe Biden stepped aside. We nominated Kamala Harris.
I think it's a little bit like the Dodgers complaining that the Braves starting pitcher who injured his shoulder yesterday isn't starting today.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the things we've been talking about on the program for some time, that Project 2025 thing, the future of the nation if Donald Trump gets elected. Heaven forbid, no. But the whole repealing of the 20th century and the middle class that was built, as opposed to someone on the other side like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who say, look, we had an incredible middle class that built this country, and it was unions that built that middle class. And that's why I think it's important to focus on labor issues while we're here. That's why I've asked Dan Pedrotti to come sit down with us. He is the Director of Capital Strategies for North America's Building Trades Unions, NABTU. Dan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. I appreciate it.
So, I mean, this is going to be a central focus, I think, of this entire campaign. That document that the Heritage Foundation dropped, 900 and some pages of terrible, focuses a good part on you and your members, and not in a good way.
Right, right. No, they put down on paper their plan to, as you said, eliminate the last table leg supporting the middle class unions, and particularly things like right to work and doubling down on their attacks on workers who are trying to organize as well. So it's both a political attack and a policy attack, an ideological attack on unions. And I think particularly for building trades members, you know, they've seen both with President Biden and Vice President Harris the overwhelming support for unions. I worked for Vice President Harris as part of her chairing the White House Worker Task Force, which its express focus was increasing union density and supporting workers. But union members and building trades members have also seen attacks on our apprenticeship system under President Trump, raising their taxes by taking away the union dues deduction. So it's both an existential attack on labor as a force at a moment where at our most popular, but it's also this death by a thousand cuts chipping away at unions as well. And that's something I think as I live in Cleveland, I've been talking to union members in Michigan for the last 2 months, is something that is getting union members to sit up and pay attention and know that their livelihood is on the line here.
And sure. I got to imagine this most recent, you know, effusive praise for Elon Musk for firing striking workers. I got to imagine that, you know, every union member in this country has got to sit up and take notice, because that arrow is in the quiver. Not like everyone's going to go on strike, but it's something that you don't want a president to go, no, we've seen what a president firing strikers has done.
Yep, it's straight out of President Reagan's playbook, and we saw, you know, that they treated this as sort of something that was funny, something that was trivial. Your workers go out and strike, they use collective action, fire them. So it's not, they're not trying to hide it this time. I know former President Trump has gone to different union events and made noises about, you know, being supportive of unions. But when push came to shove, he didn't do anything around infrastructure. President Biden and Vice President Harris did. They got the job done. They created, you know, hundreds of thousands of good jobs for union members. And we have, you know, a former president now joking about firing people who are trying to stand up for their families and the community they live in, too. It's really appalling.
Now, there's so much here to get to. I mean, the Project 2025 thing, I think, is important and one of those distinctive issues that I hope people are paying attention to.
Absolutely.
But there's also the other side of this, and that's what the Biden-Harris administration did and has done, and what I believe the Harris-Walz administration will do. And that's, as you've said, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of investments in infrastructure, in clean technologies, in jobs for your members.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned clean technology. That is a huge deal because we've talked and debated for so many years about a just transition. This administration got it done. We have now labor standards attached to wind and solar tax credits under the IRA, where we have prevailing wage, where we have apprenticeship. So there's actually there a pathway for unions to get more work, for our contractors to go to work. That's a huge step forward on projects that previously have been very low road, you know, hiring people who were forced to sleep in cars where they weren't safe, they had no voice on the job. That's wholly different. So we've seen it on everything as big as the pieces of legislation, saving pension funds for union members. You know, folks got to remember the American Rescue Plan, you know, put forward tens of billions of dollars to support pension funds, particularly Teamsters pension funds that were underfunded, that have been suffering. And then again, in my role working with the vice president, she chairs the White House Task Force on Worker Organizing and Empowerment. And they've gone out of their way to focus on increasing union density in the private sector and public sector and supporting workers like the ones at Starbucks or at Amazon who organize the union as well.
No, and if I remember that task force report, it came out and very clearly said what I think I learned as a child. Union jobs equal better lives.
Exactly.
That better wages, hours, conditions, only unions have the ability to fight for those.
Exactly. And I think there was also a Treasury report that spoke to that, that when unions are strong, the economy is strong, too. So it's both the existential level of support, and I saw it personally with the vice president and Marty Walsh, who was the vice chair. They, in Pittsburgh, when I was working there, met with union organizers who talked about how hard it is to organize a union, the terror they face when they try and speak up and exert their agency and their voice in the workplace. One worker in particular, Jennifer Choi, you know, broke down and started crying when she talked about organizing a union at Mapbox, her employer on the West Coast. And after that, most importantly, and this goes to the gig economy and, you know, what's going to be the focus of this administration, the Harris-Walz administration, the vice president and Marty met with a group of workers who had organized a union at Google Marketplace, through the steelworkers in Pittsburgh. And they had voted for a union, but they didn't yet have a collective bargaining agreement. And lo and behold, after that meeting, they got a collective bargaining agreement. So they're walking the walk in ways big and small, I think, which is really important.
No, the point for me is, you know, I go back to the original intent. I know we hear a lot of original intent arguments from my conservative friends about the Constitution, but you look at the National Labor Relations Act, the original intent was for government to encourage employers and employees to collectively bargain so that you solve problems locally.
Exactly.
And yet what we have here is exactly as you pointed out, we have a law that's ossified, one that the pendulum has swung to the side of employers to where they can harass and intimidate. And that's why someone like Tim Walz is really exciting to me, a guy who has banned captive audience meetings.
Right.
You know, the walk and the talk match. When I look at, you know, the Biden-Harris team and now the Harris-Walz team, for me, that's the important part.
Absolutely.
That the rhetoric matches.
You hit the nail on the head. You know, Governor Walz spoke to the Building Trades Conference this past April, so a room full of, you know, 3,000 union members from around the country. And he talked about the captive audience meeting example. He talked about standing up for UAW workers who are organizing in the South. But the most memorable thing for me is he talked about his first run for Congress, and his opponent during a debate said, you know, Tim Walz is in the pocket of big labor. And he said, you know, I immediately stood up and said, that is a damned lie. I am the pocket. And you know, got a huge ovation from the crowd. He has been with us throughout. And I think his choice as a vice presidential nominee really signals to the middle of the country, where I live, where you live, that this is a ticket, this is a leadership that's going to really stand up and fight for workers and for more union workers as well, at a time when unions are at their, you know, most popular.
No, because I've said, you know, I've been doing this show 19 years, and I've been saying this the whole time. You know, we built the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization during my grandparents' era.
Exactly.
They did it through smart policy, sound investment, and the secret sauce of a strong labor movement that fought for those better wages, hours, conditions. As employers were doing better, workers did better as well. So for me, the labor component of this is the, I think, one of the most important parts that sometimes gets left aside by Democrats.
Absolutely.
Now, we've seen this in the past where there's, you know, there's been a lot of talk. I truly believe this ticket, this Democratic Party right now believes in the rhetoric that they're talking about.
I've seen it, you know, firsthand. I remember the first conversation I had with the vice president before Worker Task Force meeting in May of 21. We looked at the relationship between union density and the share of income going to the top 10%. And when union density was high, that moved down. It was an inverse relationship. You can see it very clearly. And what's been broken in this country for the last 50 years is the gap now between workers' productivity and their wages. Productivity has gone up. Wages have stayed basically flat. And why is that? Because unions have been pushed down. They've been attacked. And they haven't been supported across the ideological spectrum. Now we're seeing Republicans try and make approaches to unions. It's not authentic. It's not legitimate. But I think workers are seeing now, unions are seeing now, the Democratic Party coming home to who they are and what they represent in their best capacity.
And I think it's, again, when you, it's the talk is one thing. And there was talk at the RNC of labor rights. There was talk about that. The actions, are for me, are the most important part. And I look at Jelly Bucket Joe. Joe Biden came to work every day.
Yep.
Smart policy move forward. But more importantly, put people into positions who are the best people.
Correct.
I know we had a guy who was president for 4 years, talked about the very best people. And what do we get? We get anti-union, pro-corporate people at every single level. So when I look at Biden's record, it's Jennifer Abruzzo, it's Lena Khan, it's those people who they have effect of our lives.
Yep.
It wouldn't matter if Joe Biden was still on the ticket. I'm voting for everybody that was on that team.
Absolutely.
And those are those folks.
Personnel is policy, and this administration has walked the walk on that front. And when you look at the last administration, and again, going back to building trades members, our ladder to the middle class for an increasingly diverse building trades movement is our apprenticeship movement, is our pre-apprenticeship system, where we're recruiting more people and giving them ladders of opportunity. Former President Trump tried to blow up that apprenticeship system and that pre-apprenticeship system. President Biden and Vice President Harris have supported, have expanded it, and have expanded the jobs moving in there. So it's the people waking up every day who care about these policies who are union members themselves, people like Secretary Walz as well. And even, you know, the current Labor Department is just, you know, emphatically pro-union, and we're really
as they should be.
As they should be. I mean, for example, and I've worked in the labor movement for 20 years. Julie Sue helped convene a meeting with Leo Brainerd back during our building trades conference at the White House, where she brought together people who represent workers' capital to talk about, you know, creating good union jobs in private equity. So private equity is this monstrous, predatory part of Wall Street that fires workers, that loads companies up with debt, that destroys companies. This administration talked about workers being at the center with their own money, their retirement money, and creating good union jobs and labor standards in private equity. That's something I would have never dreamed of before. But every time that we need them to stand with us, they show up. I think, you know, the vice president, by my count, has been to dozens of union training centers now. And when you go into those apprenticeship centers, you see people whose lives are opening up, who will be able to provide for their family for the next generation because they have a good union job, pension, health care, and security, and a voice at work.
So now we've talked about all this stuff, but, you know, the reality is that most of the building trades people I know, they're wearing the red hats.
Right.
I think they're starting to wake up.
Yeah.
Because there's so much of this compounding that you can't ignore everything.
Right.
So as you're out there talking to your members, as you're out there, you know, doing this get out the vote effort, are your members, you know, waking up? Because, look, I know my building trades friends are inundated day to night, just like my truck driver buddies are.
Yeah.
Day to night, right-wing blather, hate radio, top to bottom, day and night. And they learn by absorption.
Right.
Are they seeing the reality and what's being presented them? Are they seeing that?
I believe they are, and I feel like I've seen it on the ground. I was in Northern Michigan for the last 2 months, and I think, and maybe this is a little self-serving, but it's important, when your union is talking to you, it's different. When the union that hires you and sends you out on jobs, when the union that provides retirement, healthcare, that the union that trained you is talking to you, it's different. And what that union is saying to them is, look at the historic number of work opportunities we have now because of Vice President Kamala Harris and President Biden, in terms of not just the CHIPS Act and the IRA, but the Infrastructure Act and all of the investments and reshoring of manufacturing. That's something else we should talk about, is trade and reshoring manufacturing. And on the other side, look at what wasn't done under former President Trump in terms of infrastructure, but also the fact that he raised taxes for building trades members. He took away the ability for them to deduct union dues from their taxes. He attacked the apprenticeship system and tried to blow up the registered apprenticeship system, which has worked for 100 years. So when we have these conversations about kitchen table issues, I think there's a switch, there's an aha moment, but it's going to take a lot of work over these last 3 months to really continue to make that case on behalf of their union.
Because part of this also is the people that I know, they think they're going to be okay.
Right.
Well, I'm okay in what I've got. I don't, hooray for me, and I don't care about, do they think that it's finally maybe going to come home to them?
You're exactly right, Rick. I think that they're in, and we've seen this in the polling. I'm glad you hit on this, that there's this idea that I'm looking at a LIUNA sign up here now in the United Center, a laborers union. There's an idea that the union is sort of like an insurance policy, that the union will protect them. Well, that's what we do on behalf of our members. But
not just them, their families, their standard of living, their health, their retirement, everything.
But if we don't stand up now for an administration that has emphatically been the most pro-union in our lifetime, then we have lost everything that we've gained to this point and could gain going forward. And going back to something you said before about the law, this isn't the ability for workers to earn more, to keep more, to stay in the middle class isn't going to change until we enact the PRO Act. That is something that is essential, not just for the building trades unions to move, but for every union. Yep. So they have a fair process to organize. And for us to really grow and thrive and meet the moment in terms of public support, that's what's going to happen in the Harris-Walz administration in the first 100 days. And if we don't get there, we're going to continue to tread water, and the insurance policy could get canceled under the next administration if it's Trump and Vance.
That's an excellent way to put it. Lastly, I want to get some of your thoughts on, I just saw that you guys set the industry standard for offshore wind.
Yep.
A national agreement. Walk me through what that looked like real quick.
Yeah, so with Ørsted and other big firms, we now have a national project labor agreement. So it goes back to what we were saying about the Inflation Reduction Act and creating good union jobs and just transition. We now have a standard that we can hold other firms accountable to, and in places like New York and New England now, there'll be a collective bargaining agreement where workers will have a union, have a fair voice in the job, be more productive, lower the cost on the project, and continue to create density and muscle memory and more jobs in this essential space.
So basically everything that you're doing, Donald Trump and Project 2025 and the MAGA world want to completely eviscerate.
Want to blow up. Exactly.
Got it. I got it. But, and this is one of those moments, the choice is very clear, isn't
which,
it?
Which side are you on?
Absolutely. Yep.
It goes back to that essential question in the labor movement.
There you go. Dan Perdotti, I appreciate you taking some time
for
us.
Thank you, Rick.
Love to have you come back and talk to us again.
Anytime. Thank you again.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You a trades member? You a union member? Is this hitting home? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912.
That was the day the U.S. Congress approved the formation of the Commission on Industrial Relations. In the early 1900s, the terrible work conditions and entrenched resistance to union organizing had led to increased labor unrest. In 1910, two union members in San Francisco bombed the Los Angeles Times building, killing 20 people. The public outcry led officials in Washington to decide they needed to get serious about investigating the reasons behind the mounting anger of working people. The commission included 9 members, 3 workers, 3 employers, and 3 community members. The leader was Frank P. Walsh, a labor lawyer from Missouri. Led by Walsh from 1913 to 1915, the commission embarked on a sweeping investigation of the conditions of work in the United States. They conducted 740 interviews that took them 154 days to complete. Interviewees included IWW leader Big Bill Haywood, labor hellraiser Mother Jones, and champion of working people lawyer Clarence Darrow. The commission investigated the Paterson, New Jersey silk mill strike and multiple other work actions. For 3 days, the commission grilled John D. Rockefeller on the Ludlow Massacre. The result was an 11-volume compilation of testimony. 100,000 copies of a shorter final report were published. The final report described the poor working conditions at many job sites and the brutal repression of the labor movement. It critiqued the treatment of agricultural workers. Predictably, many found fault with the commission's findings. The New York Herald called the commission's chairman Walsh a Mother Jones in trousers. Despite these critics, the comprehensive report stood as a powerful, detailed review of the conditions faced by thousands of working people every day. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
As we close up today's program, I got to tell you, I look at Tim Walz's speech, and as I talked about earlier with Doug Jones, a lot there that grabbed my attention. And look, it for me personally, he could be my neighbor. He could be, look, me. The things that he's gone through, the things that he's talked about, things that I intimately identify with. You know, as we said last week on the program when it came out that when his father passed, that the family collected Social Security survivor benefits. And here's a guy who got this, as I did, and oddly enough, does not want to destroy it like we saw with Paul Ryan. So for me, this is a politician who has lived through some stuff, has come to his political positions through the hard knocks of life, has seen people struggle, suffer, tighten the belt, seen paychecks not go far enough, and has said, hey, there's got to be a better way. And using government as that tool, that's the important part of this. The idea that we can make actual change and make people's lives better, that's a great thing. And, you know, as this frame keeps coming out about, you know, Coach Walls, it started me thinking about my own experiences. Look, I coached all of my kids' sports, basketball, baseball. You know, I volunteered as a big brother for years and helped coach his football team. So you see how these kids grow. You see how the light goes on when they get it. So from a coach's perspective, it's an incredible thing. But I also remember it as a player, as that kid being coached, being that knowledge being shared and that want for you to do better. And I think about the high school football coach that I had, a guy named Jerry Younger. He passed many years ago. But, you know, in Ohio, he was football lore. Because we were a fairly small school, but competed on a bigger level. And while in the moment, I didn't appreciate the pushing, in the moment, I didn't appreciate the words that were being used, it did push me to be a much better player, a much better person, and a much better teammate. And ultimately, part of the man that I am, and a lot of it, because to be honest, without athletics, without football to begin, and then basketball and baseball and everything that came with that, I probably would not have completed high school. because of where I was in my life. You know, look, I grew up in the housing project where a lot of people unfortunately didn't, and sadly still don't. And I was, you know, with my grandparents, who they were ready to get on with their retirement. They were ready to move to the next phase of their lives. You know, taking on an incorrigible, delinquent 13-year-old was not in their cards, but they did it. And I quite easily could have seen if I would have decided I'm not going to continue, that them being unable to stop that. But it was that coach who I almost got into a fist fight with, oddly enough, that really made me want to get up every day and show up to school and do the work, and for the privilege of playing, for the privilege of taking out some of the anger I had on the playing field. And that really, really shaped who I am. So when, again, I go back to it, I'm sure people are tired of hearing this already. I'm getting the emails. When they go low, you get lower. That's the basis of football. It's leverage. So when they go low, I was always taught you push them, push their face into the mud. And as they're going down, you put your knee in their back so they don't do it again. And I see Coach Walls as one of those guys, one of those caring, compassionate people who, you know, is going to be there. And it got me thinking about, you know, my own experience with Coach Younger. Because, you know, there was a moment where some weird things happened when I was a kid. And my grandfather and I did not see eye to eye an awful lot. But I had brought my football helmet home, and he took it all apart. Weird. And I went back to the coach, and I said, look, I can't do this. And he put his arm around me and said, okay, we'll just get you another helmet. It's not that hard. And was there when I needed those moments of encouragement, those moments when you weren't ready to take the next step, those moments where you thought you couldn't go any further. And there to encourage and push. Not because it meant the world to them, but because of what it could mean to me and to the rest of the team. And that, learning those lessons, I think, are invaluable. Now, look, I got bad knees to show for it, thanks to some moments. But those are life lessons that I think that are incredible. And to see the players of his team come out there and support him as they did, that's incredible stuff. And it's the kind of stuff of Americana. It's the kind of stuff that's who we are. And that's why when I look at Tim Walls, I'm encouraged. And look, I said from the beginning, the first choice of any president or any candidate who's running for president, who's going to be their partner? Kamala Harris hit it out of the park. Because this is a guy who the right is trying as hard as they can to demonize, to make fun of, to try and tear down. This guy seems unimpeachable. His reputation, all the people have gone, yeah, he pushed me out of a snowbank. I got to question this. This is where my mind goes. In life, how many people who have sat in the Oval Office or, you know, in the vice president's chair, how many of those people have actually pushed somebody out of a snowdrift? How often do you think that's happened? We got to go back, I think. We got to have to go back, way back. Someone who's attended a bake sale, not because it was politically advantageous, but was because how they afforded to pay for a school trip or new equipment or to take coaching in sports that he doesn't know much about so that he can pay school lunch tabs. This is incredible stuff. But oddly enough, someone that I recognize, and that, you know, when we went on Twitter and I said, hey, you know, share your experience, there are a ton of people sharing those very experiences of that person who didn't have to spend all those hours coaching and planning and coming up with a playbook. As Coach Walls said, that if you make a playbook, you're going to use it. Of course you're going to use it. So I look at the moment that we're in, and I'm encouraged beyond no other that this moment, there are two people who are going to sit in the Oval Office and move a policy agenda that is going to take people like me, people like you, working people, and their needs, wants, and dreams into account. This idea of having a worker-centric, worker-focused administration. should be something that we all want, something that we all push for, something that we all believe in. I know it's my thought, it's my hope, it's my dream, but it's an amazing, amazing time. But I want to hear your thoughts. Do you identify with someone like Coach Walls? Is there someone in your background, someone that you came across when you were in high school, someone that you came across when you were a young person, someone who influenced what you've become? Can you see that influence in your everyday life now? I want to hear about it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, because I think this is an incredibly important moment, incredibly important. But so far, this convention has been obviously the most electric, most energized. And the question is, how does it go outside? I want to hear how you're feeling about this. Is it resonating outside the walls of this arena? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, download the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.